Hey everyone, it's Maria Hinojosa here, and thank you so much for listening to Latino USA. Now, you know that we like to have a lot of fun with our show, and we know that you do too. So for some more fun, like puzzles, trivia, and music games, why not check out Ask Me Another? Can you do math at the movies or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Want to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but thanks to host Ophira Eisenberg and house musician Jonathan Colton, it's a lot funnier. Play along with Ask Me Another at npr.org/podcasts. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
It was this never-ending headache of anxiety about, you know, whether I would eat or whether I would buy a specific type of paint for class.
Today, stories of survival from a young woman making it through college to a cartoonist using his art to support protest in the Dominican Republic.
I want to see solutions to my country's social challenges. Maybe it's because I lived through these problems when I was young that I really want to go beyond just criticizing and figure out how to solve them.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we look at what people do to survive. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan.
La vida no es fácil. Siempre me decía.
Welcome to Latino USA, everyone. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So I have a daughter who is about to apply to college, and I'm really excited for her. But honestly, the news coming out of colleges lately is kind of freaking me out.
Our closer look now at a crisis on campus. 60 universities have been put on notice by the Department of Education for how they've handled sexual assaults.
Two former college football players now facing decades in prison found guilty of sexually assaulting a female student in a dorm room at Vanderbilt.
Police say that 11 students apparently took some bad drugs known as Molly. Two of those students are still in critical condition.
Now the first of two reports on the ever-growing student loan debt problem.
It makes me wonder if what it takes to survive in college now has changed a lot since I went to school years ago. This is a story of one college survivor.
Hi, I'm Susie Exposito, and I'm a writer and an illustrator.
Her work has been featured in Rookie Magazine, Rolling Stone, and on MTV. She talks to us now about what it took for her to survive art school, and it took a lot.
I was a busybody in high school. I was involved in all these different clubs and extracurricular activities. I was the arts and entertainment editor at my school paper. I was in Girl Scouts. I was in photo club. I was the vice president of my art club at some point. So I was involved in so many different things. I had this really intense work ethic that I didn't really see in most of my other friends. I wasn't like the best student. It was just, I was often really like distracted and just tried to do all of the things at once. I was just really ambitious. I was the oldest of four children in my house, and I was like the second mother figure. I was usually around to like babysit. I did a lot of housework when I was growing up. Oftentimes, like, helping take care of, like, my family really got in the way of my social life. So I didn't really have an average, like, American teenhood, I guess. All my extracurricular activities at school were really just to, like, keep me out of my house. Because if I was, like, at home, then I would be used for something. They'd be like, okay, you have to be doing something. Like, I wasn't really allowed to just, like, hang out at home. I was just dying to go to college. I especially wanted to go to college outside of Florida, which is where I grew up. I got accepted to a college in Manhattan, and I had a really good scholarship, so I just went for it, and everyone was mad at me for for leaving. When I got to college, I was around people who were way wealthier than like anyone I had ever met in my life. I'd never been around that much privilege in my life before. I thought that I knew what rich people were like. You know, I thought that I encountered them sometimes back home in Florida, but really I had no idea. I was meeting kids with more money than what they knew what to do with. I couldn't help but want to impress them, you know? I found myself really trying to like all the things that these really rich kids liked. Within the first couple of months of my freshman year, my dad became unemployed. This was around 2007, so lots of people were losing their jobs, especially in Florida. I was working 2 to 3 jobs at a time from the time I was a freshman. I served coffee and I nannied. I did a lot of data entry. I've had professors totally just like condescend to me because I didn't have all the money for all the right supplies that I needed. It was this never-ending headache of anxiety about, you know, whether I would eat or whether I would buy a specific type of paint for class. It was just so silly. Like, you know, so I was like buying generic brands and then my professors would scold me in front of the other students, which is incredibly embarrassing. It was my sophomore year, actually, when I think that's when I was doing like really bad money-wise. And a lot of people are talking about student debt and they focus on what happens like after, which, you know, it's important to talk about like the consequences of borrowing a ton of money, but also like people need support while they're in college. I was kind of a train wreck because I was working all of the time. It's like if I wasn't in class, then I was working. I would try and be involved on campus, you know, like the way that I was in high school. Neither of my parents did the conventional like 4-year college track. You know, my mom went to night school when I was a little kid. My dad had a GED. My dad didn't go to college. I felt like a ton of pressure just to like make it work. My dad would always grill me like my whole life about going to a 4-year college and doing it like, you know, most Americans do. I just felt that intense immigrant guilt, you know? My sophomore year, I was sexually assaulted by my boyfriend. I dated someone who was much more privileged than I was and extremely entitled. And we were both 19. The first time I was really confused. The second time I broke up with him because I was so confused. Like I came from like a really conservative part of Florida. So like, no, I didn't know what consent was. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what anything was, really. After it happened, it was so hard to actually find a way to rectify it in any way. Like I looked through my school's policies because both times it happened in my dorm, and I just like kept looking through my school's policy. I kept looking through the dorm policy. I was an RA, like I should have known exactly how to deal with it. An RA is a resident assistant. They make sure that everything's running smoothly in student housing. I knew that there was nothing that my school could do, and I figured that if I went to the police, it would be extremely ineffective. I did a lot of web comics in those days. I had my own comics blog that I was keeping up with, and I was really determined not to let the things that had happened to me just deter me from drawing. So I just kept drawing cartoons, and eventually I got like the greatest internship. I started interning for this organization called SAFER, and it's an acronym that stands for Students Active for Ending Rape. They asked me to draw educational cartoons about consent and activism, and it's really great because I found a way to connect my art with something much bigger than me, which I think a lot of artists have trouble doing. It's so easy for artists to just retreat into themselves, you know, and make their art super individual. I was making art that was intentionally supposed to reach out to other people. I made art that was intentionally supposed to be less alienating for people, especially people who had gone through things that I'd gone through. The purpose of SAFER was to educate students on their rights as students, but also to help empower them to take a good look at their sexual assault policies and try and amend them where needed. Me and my friends realized that our school didn't have a proper sexual assault policy. We got a ton of pushback from like both students and admins, you know. They tried to pass it off like it wasn't a problem, but I was an RA. Being an RA, I had to deal with a lot of things in student housing. Guess where a lot of sexual assault happens on campus? It happens in the dorms. And so it was really annoying coming up against people who are like, it doesn't really happen here, you know, or people who'd say things like, oh, well, there are more girls than guys at our school, so like, it's not really a problem, you know. But also, I mean, there were men who were sexually assaulted. It happens to people like gay and straight. It doesn't matter. The policy change finally passed my senior year. Being able to make like a simple but like big policy change like that, it convinced me that there was more to my life than just constantly struggling. Luckily, I was starting to form like a really tight group of friends who were really supportive. You know, one time the person who assaulted me, he like spotted me from across the street and he tried to walk over like to talk to me. And then my friends just like formed a wall around me and they just started yelling at him to just like back off. And that was kind of great. I write for Rolling Stone freelance, so I guess I'm not like beholden to them. So in light of that article about the gang rape that may or may not have happened at UVA, I feel like it's even more important that we have this conversation about survivors of campus sexual assault. The thing that everyone seems stuck on is whether it happened or it didn't. And what I personally think we should focus on is whether the resources were there for her to get help if it happened. College ended up being the hardest thing that I ever had to do in my life. Even though I had it better than my parents, even though my parents had it better than their parents, I think that this sense of struggle still has its way of passing itself down. I really just needed people around me to tell me that I wasn't crazy. I found a lot of support in my friends. Just the idea that things would change was enough for me to power through.
Writer and illustrator Susie Exposito, she found what she needed to survive, a community. And she also learned one of the most important elements of survival, which is hope, just the mere idea of change. So today, we explore the kinds of things people need to survive, a living wage, food, a home. But what are the basics? Under what conditions do we all survive? And what do we have to change to make it? Coming up on Latino USA.
Somebody wrote up a contract on a napkin. Now they were pressed to make the payment or pay the house off, and so they're in trouble.
How some undocumented people find a way to become homeowners. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Mi voz puede volar. Puede atravesar cualquier herida, cualquier tiempo, cualquier soledad, sin que la pueda controlar, toma forma de canción. así es mi voz, que sale de mi corazón y volará, sin yo querer, por los caminos más lejanos, por los sueños que soñé, será reflejo del amor, de lo que me tocó vivir, será la música de fondo, de lo mucho que sentí, oye mi son, mi viejo son, tiene la clave de cualquier generación, en el alma de mi gente, en el cuero del tambor, en las manos del conguero, en los pies del bailador, yo viviré. Allí
estaré. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hola, mis queridos listeners. It's Maria here. Just a reminder, once again, that if you love Latino USA, there are two small but really, really important things that you can do to help us. First, if you listen to us on iTunes, por favor, take a couple of minutes and rate and review our show. It's really a lot more helpful than you can even imagine. And if you really love what we do here, and we know you do, just go over to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. Even just a few dollars from everyone who listens would make a huge difference in helping us make radio for all of you. Muchas gracias from all of us at Latino USA. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Across the U.S., cities like New York, Philadelphia, Atlanta, Denver, and Austin all allow some form of street vending on sidewalks. But in Chicago, street vendors can only sell prepared foods in parks. For many immigrants, running a small business by street vending is a way to survive, frankly, even to thrive. The Chicago City Council is considering a measure to lift the ban on street vending on sidewalks. If it passes, it would mean safer conditions and more economic opportunity, but it could also put other small businesses on the defense. Colleen Pellissier has our story.
It's Sunday morning on Chicago's West Side. I'm looking for Claudia Perez. The other street vendors in the neighborhood know just where she is. 26th and Hamlin. That's her spot. I find her standing next to a tamale cart with chipping yellow paint. Under a thick scarf and two jackets, she's smiling despite the cold.
Por chicken or cheese?
We're here in Little Village, a predominantly Latino neighborhood. Cars whiz by. The sidewalks are full of people, their hands stuffed in their pockets, their heads bent low against the chill. Claudia is 52 years old. She's been selling tamales here for 17 years. A dollar for one or $10 for a dozen.
Get a chicken. Okay. Tres. Nada más. De todo. Rojo, no?
A man pulls up in a truck and shouts to get Claudia's attention. He's a regular.
A ver a qué hora va a venir por el suyo. Tienen que venir. Allá no se lo voy a llevar.
I was wondering when you'd come to get yours, she teases. You gotta come to me because I'm not gonna bring them to you.
Ándale pues, bye. Gracias.
Claudia takes pride in her food and her business. Here in her kitchen, she works 7 days a week, sometimes 16 hours a day. Now she even has three employees who work during the week while she cooks.
A diario, sí. Porque tienen un sabor y ya frisados tienen otro sabor.
I cook my tamales every day, she says, because they are better if they're fresh. During the summer and fall, Claudia can earn up to $4,000 a month. But she takes a risk every time she pushes her cart. Selling prepared food on Chicago streets is illegal, except in city parks. Vendors will sometimes alert each other by calling or texting if the police are out ticketing. They face fines of $50 to $500 and even arrests. Claudia can't remember how many times she's been fined, but she does remember her last arrest.
Estaba vendiendo y de repente llegó el policía, fue en enero. Y llegó el policía y me dice,
I was out selling and suddenly the police showed up, she says. He said, did you know you can't sell that? No, I didn't know that. Well, put your hands behind your back. I'm going to handcuff you. Claudia says that the officer cursed at her and called her a criminal.
Que él me dijo que me estaba pisoteando. Los indocumentados, dice, así tienen que ser tratados.
He told me he was coming down hard on me because undocumented people didn't need to come to this country, she says. Claudia was taken to the police station and after many hours was released with a $120 fine. After the arrest, she considered shutting down her business.
Llorando se lo dije a mis hijos, saben que ya se acabó mi trabajo. O sea, yo ya fui arrestada.
She says, I was crying. I told my children, my work is over. The police told me if they saw me again, I'd be put in jail for a month or two. But after a few weeks, Claudia went back to selling her tamales. She's her family's sole provider, and street vending is the only work that pays enough money to support everyone. All three of Claudia's children have also been arrested for selling tamales on the street. She says, if the city legalized street vending,
libre. Trabajaría con más libertad.
I'd feel much freer. I'd be able to work more freely, she says. But as of now, the law keeps her from doing that.
This law is about preventing poor people from starting small businesses. It's about preventing aspiring entrepreneurs from starting businesses in the most affordable way.
That's Beth Krager, director of the Clinic on Entrepreneurship at the University of Chicago Law School. She helped draft a proposal to allow street vendors to sell prepared foods in city-inspected kitchens. She can't understand why the ban is still on the books, since many city officials say they appreciate the character vendors bring to Chicago's neighborhoods.
And the only explanation that does make any sense for why this law is in place the way it is that the established businesses have asked for it.
One of those businesses belongs to Gabriela Padilla. She and her husband own Don Pepe, a Mexican restaurant just two blocks east of Claudia's corner. As the lunch crowd starts to come in, Gabriela explains they've worked hard to build a customer base. Having street cart vendors around hasn't helped.
I understand they're trying to build a way to support their families. I definitely understand that. The only thing is that I think they should operate legal. They just cannot park in front of a restaurant and sell same things that you have because they're taking away the clients that you can have.
While she talks, Gabriela's eight-week-old daughter sleeps beside her. Like the street cart vendors, Gabriela and her husband are entrepreneurs just trying to make it. But unlike the vendors, they have extra expenses to pay, like taxes and almost $4,000 a month in rent. Then there are the inspections by the health department.
Usually you have somebody come here. Of course, they do not schedule an appointment, so it can be any time. And they look at the dishes. They need to be upside down. If we have hot water, cold water, both. Anything that you think that it won't cost you a ticket, it will.
At the moment, the proposal to change the law is going nowhere. But what would Gabriela do if it passed? Like most entrepreneurs, she's resourceful. She says she'd get a couple of street carts, vending for Don Pepe. For Latino USA, I'm Colleen Pellicer in Chicago.
Una familia, muchos rincones, la habitación con nueve sillones, tantas polillas, tantos colchones, están todos rotos.
Now, not only do many undocumented people run their own businesses, they also are homeowners. I'll never forget seeing an ad on television in Texas saying, "Con o sin papeles, compre su casa," which means, with or without papers, buy your home. In fact, a 2009 Pew Hispanic Center study shows that a third of undocumented immigrants own homes. Some buy their houses with cash, literally mattress money that is saved up over the years. But for others, without that kind of savings, options for home mortgage financing are scarce. So they do what they have to. And sometimes that means informal arrangements with risky consequences. Rowan Moore Garrity of Northwest Public Radio brings us this story from Yakima, Washington.
After an early morning shift packing apples, Maria leans on the kitchen counter of her tidy home in the Yakima Valley in rural central Washington. Her house has come a long way since she moved in 8 years ago.
No tenía puertas. Ya era todo esto. Las ventanas no servían.
There were no doors, she says. The windows didn't work. The floors were shoddy. You couldn't turn the lights on.
Todo esto, yo he pagado por él.
I paid for everything you see. This is my work from all these years.
O sea, mi trabajo de todo este tiempo, aquí está.
Unzipping a backpack, she spreads papers over every surface of the countertop. She's got receipts for house payments to Countrywide and Bank of America, stretching back to 2007.
Todo esto son los pagos de durante 8 años que estamos aquí.
Here are my pay slips from the last 8 years. All the papers, Maria says.
Aquí están todos los papeles.
One important piece is missing from all this paperwork, though. An actual mortgage agreement. That's because the mortgage Maria has been paying all this time is not her own.
Dueño de la casa, mas no del préstamo.
We own the house, but not the loan, she says. Maria wants to use her first name only. She came here from Mexico almost 20 years ago when she was still a teenager. While it's not illegal for banks to issue home loans to undocumented immigrants, the federal government, which underwrites most mortgages, won't back them up.
The typical mortgage application asks, are you a U.S. citizen?
That's Diane Cipollone with an advocacy group called the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Or it asks, are you a permanent resident alien?
Most banks require a social security number as proof of legal residence. Those that do offer alternative loans using an ITIN or taxpayer ID number often don't advertise it. That makes buying a home the conventional way almost impossible for people like Maria. Still, after years of living in crowded rentals, she was determined to do it. I didn't want to throw my money away anymore, Maria says. I wanted somewhere to call my own, where they couldn't turn me out. She ended up working out a deal with a woman from her husband's hometown in Mexico, who had already qualified for a mortgage.
Supuestamente pagamos una cantidad.
We were supposed to put up a down payment and continue making payments until we could change the mortgage into our name, she says.
Y ya nosotros íbamos a seguir con el pago hasta que la pudiéramos cambiar a nombre de nosotros.
But arrangements like this can hurt both parties. First, let's say someone in Maria's position falls behind on payments. Who's responsible?
The person who actually took out the loan is the borrower. It's their credit that's being impaired, and that's the person who's personally responsible for the debt.
Then there's the question of refinancing for someone like Maria. Diane Cipollone.
If you're in the property and you've been making the payments, but you are not the borrower, then the lender is not going to talk to you.
But the biggest risk is the due-on-sale clause in nearly every residential mortgage agreement. If the bank finds out the home has been transferred,
the lender can call the entire mortgage due and payable. You either have to pay it off, or they can foreclose.
Over the years, Maria has made payments of more than $80,000. But her situation is starting to unravel. It turns out the mortgage she's been paying has a variable interest rate. The payment amounts went up without her knowing. According to the bank, she's fallen $17,000 behind schedule. The balance on the loan is the same as it was 8 years ago.
Ahora, si queremos salvarla, supuestamente, tenemos que pagar los 17. Entonces, todos estos 8 años ha sido, yo creo, puro interés, o no sé, porque todavía debemos esta cantidad.
If we want to save the house, we have to pay that $17,000, which means that everything we've been paying over the years is straight interest, she says. The original borrower has left town, and Maria's having trouble figuring out her options.
We have individuals that come after the fact, after they've gone into a difficult transaction.
Nick Marquez is a real estate broker in Yakima who works with Spanish speakers. He says immigrants without real estate experience often enter into agreements they don't fully understand.
Somebody wrote up a contract on a napkin. Now they were pressed to make the payment or pay the house off, and so they're in trouble.
Sometimes it's rent-to-own contracts or owner financing where the risk falls entirely on the buyer. Or relatives using their own names to take out mortgages for undocumented family members. That's mortgage fraud. Illegal and complicated.
If the individual at the time was single, says, oh yeah, I'll do it for you. And then a couple years down the line, he finds a wife, has children, now wants to buy his own home.
he won't be able to get another mortgage without selling his first house. Marquez still fields lots of calls from undocumented immigrants eager to buy a home, with or without a mortgage. For them, the American dream is still clouded with uncertainty. For Latino USA, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Yakima, Washington.
Surviving can mean working together, and it's often about adapting. It's like Charles Darwin said, it's survival of the fittest. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario wanted to tell me about one of her favorite recent survival stories, and she's joining me now in the studio. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Maria.
All right, so we're talking about survival.
Yes.
And?
And, you know, there's a lot of talk lately as media's been changing over the last few years, the internet, everybody's terrified. And one group that's been scared has been Hollywood, because it's hard for them to get people to actually pay a lot of money to go see movies.
But it seems like we hear that everything is going great in Hollywood, but not so much, eh?
Well, the box office numbers in terms of big openings, those are still really, really big, in part because of, like, inflation, 3D prices, all kinds of stuff. But in terms of actually getting people to turn out week after week, that's changed a lot. I mean, think about it. Years ago, I know when I was growing up, a movie was number one for multiple weeks in a row or sometimes, right? Not so much anymore. It's usually a big opening.
It's like you're up there for a week, maybe
yeah.
two.
Exactly. Guess who are the biggest repeat moviegoers in the country?
Okay, I love this particular. I don't know if you're going to try to surprise me with this one, but it's a number that I love.
Yeah.
Which is one out of every four movie tickets in the United States is bought by a Latino.
One of the things about the statistics of moviegoers is that repeat viewers are very often Latino. People who go to the movies often, right? So not just people that are going to the movies, but are going back over and over again. So it's interesting to me that one franchise that we've talked about a lot in the last couple of years is The Fast and the Furious.
Here it comes, The Fast and the Furious.
You don't turn your back on family. Even when they do.
All right, so this is your favorite franchise?
It's not necessarily my favorite, but I'll tell you what, that people seem to not realize unless they are fans, it is the most diverse.
What?
Yeah, it is the most diverse Hollywood franchise. Think about it. You've got Vin Diesel, who is this ambiguous star. He actually doesn't really talk about exactly what his makeup is, but he does identify as a person of color. You got Michelle Rodriguez, who is, you know, the main Latina character who's in the majority of the movie. Some of the cast comes and goes throughout the different parts, but the core group of people who stars in this movie, it's about a very diverse group of people that consider each other family.
So is this talked about a lot? Like, is this the notion of, wow, you know, Fast and Furious really successful? Diverse cast. Does it have anything to do with it? Is it talked about or is it not?
I've only actually seen it get talked about more recently, like in the last couple of years. It's something that I think the audience that was already going to it knew and recognized and really loved. But in terms of people actually recognizing that that is a thing, that I've seen only more recently. You know, if you're worried about getting people to the box office to actually see a movie, these movies are astounding because with each sequel, for the last few, they're making more money than they were
wow.
with the previous ones.
Talk about survival.
Right.
That's extraordinary.
Exactly. And think about it. Furious 7, right? That's what's out right now. Furious 7. The seventh movie, would the seventh movie in a franchise be a big deal? Well, Furious 7 had the ninth biggest box office opening of all time.
My God, because I was just thinking like Jaws number 7.
More money was spent seeing Furious 7 in its opening weekend than was for any of the previous movies.
So is the message to Hollywood, do you think they're getting it, that if you want to survive, it's about really understanding actually who that audience is and the fact that that particular audience is going to grow.
Roxane Gay, who is a really fantastic writer. She's got a book out called Bad Feminist. I want to say 2 years ago, she wrote a great little article about how she considers those movies to be a not so guilty pleasure, in part because the audience does see themselves reflected. So you think it's a really silly movie, and it is, but like it's kind of subtly projecting this kind of, you know, very diverse, equal opportunity weird world. I mean, their only main issue is if you're not part of the family, then you're not part of the family, but you could be whoever you are and be part of the family.
And it looks like they're saying, be whoever you are, you can be part of the family. And if we're together, that's how we're going to survive, right? We got each other's back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of their whole thing.
Thank
yeah.
you, Daisy. That
was
great.
A little subtle message. Thanks, Maria.
I don't have friends. I got family.
Coming up on Latino USA,
when we saw how much was being dumped, saturating the dump site, our local landfill, just beautiful product. With all the need, how could we possibly allow this to happen?
A way to save food and reach people who need it. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Does it feel the same when the moon comes back again? Are you just pretending this is not the ending?
Hey, everyone. It's Maria Hinojosa here, and thank you so much for listening to Latino USA. Now, you know that we like to have a lot of fun with our show, and we know that you do, too. So for some more fun, like puzzles, trivia, and music games, why not check out Ask Me Another? Can you do math at the movies or name commercial jingles sung in Italian? Want to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but thanks to host Ophira Eisenberg and house musician Jonathan Colton, it's a lot funnier. Play along with Ask Me Another at npr.org/podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl. With flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide, more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking survival. Now, over half of the produce grown in Mexico and imported by the U.S. and Canada comes through one town, Nogales, Arizona. $4 billion worth of food, in fact. But many fruits and vegetables don't survive and get rejected before they leave Nogales. Reporter Lisa Morehouse tells us now that a part of that produce can get a second life.
And the eggplant and the romas, tomato on the vine, these are the romas.
Yolanda Soto walks through a building overflowing with fruits and vegetables on a street called Produce Drive. Forget about the usual warehouse worker's uniform of boots and heavy jackets. Soto's wearing bright pink, head to toe.
And we have cucumbers. Well, I can't reach, I'm too short. And they're really in very good condition.
Soto runs Borderlands Food Bank. Every year, it rescues about 40 million pounds of safe, edible fruits and vegetables headed for the landfill. That's about one serving of produce for every child in the U.S.
As you can see, this is a Mexican gray squash. Just the little bits of scarring, it's perfectly good. It's great product. But because it had some scarring, they couldn't sell it. Who's going to buy it?
U.S. consumers think good-tasting produce has to look perfect on the outside.
We are crazy. Because the waste is enormous and it's not right.
Just down the street from Borderlands, Jaime Chamberlain sits in his office above a huge produce warehouse. His company, JC Distributing, will import 7 million boxes of produce from Mexico this season.
We're able to import fruits and vegetables from any country we want, and we no longer live in that area where our parents or grandparents used to tell us this is out of season. You know, you can't have strawberries, you can't have zucchini, because that's not in season right now.
But about 40% of food in the U.S. goes to waste, in fields, on grocery store shelves, in our refrigerators. And because we import so much produce from Mexico, plenty gets rejected right here in Nogales, before it can even begin its journey to you. That starts with Customs and Border Protection.
At the U.S. border, all our fruits and vegetables and whatever we're importing is subject to inspection by about 40 different government agencies.
Searching for anything from drugs to pests. After that, in Chamberlain's warehouse, USDA inspectors pull samples from stacks of tomato boxes, checking that each fruit meets quality and size standards. Then Chamberlain inspects it too. Here, he's looking at ripeness. These light pink tomatoes.
That color is fantastic to travel to the East Coast with.
There's no full blood red tomatoes today, but if there were.
The full red needs to be sold tomorrow. There is a perishable timing to this. So.
When that's the case, and Jaime Chamberlain doesn't have the right buyer, he calls Yolanda Soto. When Borderlands Food Bank started 20 years ago, it did what a lot of food banks do. Hand out boxes full of non-perishable emergency food, not produce. Soto changed that.
When we saw how much was being dumped, saturating the dump site, our local landfill, just beautiful product. And with all the need, how could we possibly allow this to happen?
In the U.S., about 15% of people struggle with hunger. In Arizona, it's about 20%. Soto reached out to her neighbors at the scores of produce distribution warehouses around her.
Going from distributor to distributor and asking them to please call us before they decided to dump and that we would pick up.
We are like five drivers. Each one we go out like five or maybe six times a day.
Hector Elias drives from Borderlands to a nearby warehouse where he backs up the truck's trailer to door number 10. He looks over pallets of grape tomatoes originally intended for California.
I mean, it's too red right now, no? So by the time they get to California, it's gonna be no good no more.
But Borderlands can redistribute these ripe tomatoes regionally within hours. Or with big loads of less ripe produce that can handle a long haul, Yolanda Soto gets on email. She's got a list of 200 hunger relief organizations across the country.
And I say, hi, guys. You want some eggplant, cucumber, and tomato?
It's first come, first served. The agencies handle transportation and pay Borderlands Food Bank 2 pennies per pound.
So a trailer load maximum, you're going to pay $800, which is nothing. You're talking about $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 worth of product.
Thousands of people also show up for Powwow. Produce on Wheels Without Waste, weekly distributions in Phoenix and Tucson. Anyone's welcome. For a $10 donation, each person can haul off 60 pounds.
Pack as much in there as you can.
Looks like I got some squash and cucumbers.
This is the best line there.
Every time they came here, I thought this was local produce. But it's not. Comes from Mexico, which is all right. They grow good stuff.
It's not just for my family. It's for like three other groups of people.
One particular person is an elderly man that just can't get out, and he needs to eat.
Borderlands.
Back at Borderlands Food Bank, Yolanda Soto's still answering phones. She's got another donation, this for 30 pallets of colored bell pepper. She has lots of future plans for Borderlands.
Where I could rescue millions more product, and I could also do composting, I could do juicing, I could do dehydration and canning.
All she needs is a bigger warehouse. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Nogales, Arizona.
Our report is a collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, an investigative reporting nonprofit focusing on food, agriculture, and environmental health. And Lisa Morehouse produced this piece during a fellowship at Hedgebrook, a residency for women writers. To learn more about food waste in the U.S., visit our website, latinousa.org. What else do we need to survive? It's not pretty, but we all need money. In the U.S. now, the debate over minimum wage continues. Most recently, fast food workers are mobilizing to demand major wage hikes in order for them to survive. But this isn't the only country where people are fighting for higher wages. The Dominican Republic has the second lowest minimum wage in all of Latin America. Only Mexico's is lower. For months now, Dominican workers have been hoisting signs and protesting outside government buildings demanding better pay. But so far, it hasn't worked. One cartoonist, though, is trying a different approach, using humor to draw attention to social inequality. Kate Manning has our story.
Christian Hernandez is busy rushing a felt tip pen over a thick white paper when he gets a call from his editor. He scans the drawing and emails it in just in time for his newspaper's 1 o'clock deadline. Now he points to his creation on the computer screen.
Here we're seeing a street vendor. It's important to point out here that this vendor earns more than someone with an official job. And so here a little boy says to his dad, "Papa, you think that in this country we aren't earning lots of money?" Then the dad answers, "No, son, it's just that with what they pay us, we can't buy much."
In the Dominican Republic, the minimum wage hasn't kept up with inflation. Sugarcane workers, for example, make only 38 cents an hour, according to the U.S. State Department. That's a fraction of the living wage, which estimates peg at about $3 an hour. This means that many workers can't support their families. They often become self-employed or turn to illegal activities. The minimum wage is a heated issue throughout the country, and it hits close to home for Christian.
My dad passed away. I lived with my mom, who raised five kids on minimum wage in absolute poverty.
Christian got an after-school job at a magazine stand when he was 11. There, he devoured comic books in his free time and started drawing his first cartoons. 34 years later, Christian is the DR's most famous satirical cartoonist.
My greatest achievement, coming from poverty, was beating it.
Now Christian dresses in head-to-toe Lacoste, but his past won't let go of him. That's why he does what he does. Caricatures of clumsy police, sweaty workers, and bobble-headed politicians fill sketchbooks stacked high in the corner. The cartoons are his weapons of resistance.
I want to see solutions to my country's social challenges. Maybe it's because I lived through these problems when I was young that I really want to go beyond just criticizing and figure out how to solve them.
The comment section of Christian's Facebook page is full of suggestions. His 10,000 followers create online support for ongoing protests to raise the minimum wage. Silvio Orena marches with eight co-workers in front of the Congress building in Santo Domingo, the capital. He and his friends load and unload cargo ships. Their jobs are vital. Sugar and minerals are exported, while many necessities are imported. But when business is slow, they make even less than minimum wage.
We are the workers who move the country's economy. But even so, being a dock worker here means you'll starve.
The dock workers are here with hundreds of other protesters. They press against a line of police wearing helmets and holding plastic shields. The workers hand over their demands in a manila folder to Congresswoman Guadalupe Valdez. She responds through a giant loudspeaker sitting on the bed of a dented pickup truck.
Raising salaries is a fundamental issue that we have to tackle in order to make sure that thousands of workers like you can find a decent job with a fair wage.
The Congresswoman seems to side with the workers, but union leader Pepe Abreu says it's just lip service. The government promised to adjust the minimum wage back in July last year. It still hasn't happened. That's partly because the situation is so complicated. Here, the minimum wage differs by industry and location. Pepe says the workers, the government, and the private sector all want different things.
Even though there's a lot of discussion about the subject, when the time comes to make a decision, it's never easy. There are a lot of competing interests.
That's for sure. The Government Salary Committee says it has to carefully review how raising wages would affect each industry and each location. But critics say the government and industry are too cozy, that politicians don't want to anger their powerful business allies. Meanwhile, businesses say they'd have to cut jobs if they raise wages. But Pepe disagrees.
For businessmen, they think that their ability to stay competitive depends on keeping wages low. We're against this. Low salaries should never be used as a way to stay competitive.
Pepe's union is demanding a 30% increase to wages across the board. The raise still wouldn't be up to living wage for most workers. But the likelihood of even that happening isn't a sure thing. politicians, workers, and businesses still haven't sat down to start negotiating. Back in his breezy home office, Christian Hernandez watches the debate closely. Piles of disheveled newspapers crowd his desk. He brushes them aside to work on a drawing of yesterday's protest.
I don't want to see it as a job, but rather as a contribution. Something that reaches people and makes me feel fulfilled.
Christian doesn't go to the protest himself. He says he's just a soft-spoken cartoonist, and his drawings speak louder than his words. For Latino USA, this is Katie Manning.
Another important part of survival is taking care of yourself, both physically and mentally. So for today's sabiduría, we turn to the boxing ring. Sammy Vasquez, the Who Can Mexican, is the welterweight champion for the National and International Boxing Associations. He's also a veteran with two tours of duty in Iraq. Here's Vasquez now on how his experiences on the battlefield find their way into the ring.
Vasquez very relaxed in there. See, just let his punches fly.
My name is Sammy, the Who Can Mexican Vasquez Jr. I started boxing when I was 9 years old. I used to get bullied, and I told my dad, he asked me if I wanted to start boxing, and I said, yeah. You need to get to a place that would just keep you sane, you know? And then the boxing gym was always that place for me. My grandfather's from Sonora, Mexico, and I take a lot of pride in our Mexican heritage. You know, yeah, I'm white as they come, and I don't speak Spanish, but it still, derives in me. You know what I mean? It's in my blood. I joined the military in 2003, December 1st of 2003. I did two tours to Iraq, 2005 and 2006, Camp Habaniya, Iraq. And then I also did 2008, 2009 at Taji, Iraq. You know, I was a young kid, my first deployment, 19 years old. You're there for a year and you're going through them experiences like that. You grow up really fast. I've got blown up a couple times. I got knocked unconscious one time. But besides that, I haven't. Bullets just missed me, So I got lucky in those aspects. But you've been blown up, you've been blown up. When I say I've been blown up, I mean there was an IED on the side of the road, which is an improvised explosive device, which is a bomb. It blown up next to my Humvee. I mean, it's just a bomb, basically, blown up right on the side of your car. I mean, it crushes your ears. I mean, you have a ringing for days. You have a headache. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty intense. Boxing it gets me away. It puts me in a place that, I just enjoy. And I don't have to think about anything else. But boxing and hitting a bag, and which is why I set up a gym in Iraq, because that was my space. When I walked through there, it just took me out of Iraq. When you go to war, you don't know. You wake up every day not knowing if it's your last day or not. You know what I mean? Because you could be gone like that. But in a boxing ring, I'm thankful to even be able to do my dream, and I know that I'm gonna walk out of this ring.
And that's it for today, mis queridos listeners. Keep on surviving and keep on thriving. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. And I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
NPR, they should be.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to improve women's economic opportunities around the world. More information is available at hewlett.org. And the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. This is NPR.